This is September 20th, 2009, and today's Teisho and the next one, at least, and possibly even the one after that, will be on anger, in particular the ninth precept, resolve not to indulge in anger, but to exercise forbearance. I think no one needs to be told that anger in its many forms seems to have been surging lately, this summer, especially in August. The media is all too happy to broadcast these town hall meetings where people are up in arms. Some people are up in arms about certain aspects of the president's ideas about health care reform. And we know that there was this incident in when the president gave an address to a joint session of Congress, and one of the congressmen violated all tradition by yelling out at one point to the president, "You lie." And then there's just been so much discussion about that, and then there have been eruptions of anger in sports this summer, and it's been I've been meaning for some time now to get into this precept again, and it seems like I want to strike while the iron is hot. Anger is something that I don't know if anyone doesn't have a problem with anger, some kind of problem. I don't mean with exceptional displays of anger. I mean that anger is a powerful force that seems to be especially troublesome to people in spiritual practice. Not that we have more of it than other people, but that we tend to worry about it more and see it as something that we shouldn't have. I think this is fair to say that whereas in the wider culture, anger may be seen as something that shows how strong and powerful you are. In spiritual practice, I think many of us come to practice thinking, anger bad, how can I get rid of it? Well, we can't get rid of it. Let's just get that out on the table. It is a form of human vitality. It's energy. Well, when I say we can't get rid of it, I don't know. Possibly in supreme perfect enlightenment, you can get beyond anger so it doesn't even arise in the faintest, subtlest form. I wouldn't know about that. But I think it's such a remote state of attainment for all of us that we shouldn't even try to consider that. What we have to really face is the nature of anger and how we can manage it once it does arise. And that's where I'm going to start now with just the nature of anger. I'm going to be drawing from a couple of books that I reviewed last night. One is a little older. It's called Emotional Intelligence by Daniel Goleman. And then the other is more recent. It's called Destructive Emotions: How Can We Overcome Them? So I'm going to start with the latter, the more recent one. In this book, Destructive Emotions, is based on a dialogue with the Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama dialoguing with a number of Western Buddhist scientists and psychologists and others in a, I assume it was in Dharamsala where he lives, the Dalai Lama lives. It's one of the Mind and Life Institute conferences. And there's a lot of brain science in this book. And most of the book really is an edited transcript of these 3 or 4 days of meetings where they toss around all these things about negative emotions. So in the book, Negative Emotions, now let me just say that, this book emphasizes more the Tibetan Buddhist understanding of emotions. But what I'm going to read, I think, applies. It's certainly would not be at odds with my understanding of emotions, or what I would see as the Zen understanding of it. They list anger as one of the 6 main mental afflictions. The 6 of these are attachment or craving is the first, anger is the second, pridefulness, ignorance and delusion, afflictive doubt, and afflictive views. Notice they're called afflictions because they're not all emotions. Anger is a word for a whole family of emotions. And they are in all different degrees of strength, anywhere from just mild irritation and annoyance all the way through other forms of hostility or ill will to absolute fury or what we could call wrath. Other forms of it are indignation, self-righteous anger, sulking, passive anger and revenge. Of course, there's also resentment and hatred. So when we list anger in our 3 poisons, for example, when we do the repentance gatha, we saw all evil actions committed by me since time immemorial, stemming from greed, anger, and delusion. That word anger represents really all these different forms of enmity or hostility, from the mildest to the most extreme. So that's really what we're talking about with anger. It's also listed in the Tibetan Buddhist system as one of 20 derivative mental afflictions. That is, the 5 kinds of it are 5 of the 20. The 5 are wrath, resentment, spite, envy or jealousy, and cruelty. And what's interesting about anger is because it, in itself, in its purest form, it's just energy, just vitality. It can have constructive applications. There can be, or at least it can be argued that there is constructive anger. But it's debatable, and that's one of the things they do debate in this conference. The Dalai Lama questioning these Westerners about constructive anger. In fact, he asks, if it's constructive, is it really anger? So the book is this book, Destructive Emotions, is organized in chapters where each list recording the presentation of a different presenter, and this thing about constructive anger, this was presented by Richard Davidson, who has become well known as someone who's been directing cutting-edge research, neuroscience into emotions, and relationship between the brain and its functions on the one hand, and meditation. And he makes the point here. The wonderful thing about emotions is that they focus you. They get you started. And then you're free to respond to what happens next. That's why they are adaptive. When they're maladaptive, you have a long refractory period and you respond to things that aren't there. And the refractory period refers to the thoughts that follow the initial simple emotional, the arising of the emotion. Then come the thoughts. We'll get more back to that later. And then he goes on, when we say that anger is altogether to be discarded, I think we should make a distinction between anger as an arising emotion and what comes in the chaining of thoughts that follows. That is very important because it's precisely what makes the difference between someone who is trained and someone who is not trained. Many of you have heard me make this point over and over again in Taisho, that it's not that the enlightened person doesn't experience anger, it's that she or he doesn't cling to it as long. That's where we can really find progress in practice. Roshi Kaplo used to quote his first teacher, Harada Roshi, as saying that the anger of the developed person in Zen is like snow falling on wet pavement. It's there, but then it's not. It just vanishes. And what I've noticed in myself, and I'm sure some of you could testify to the same thing, is that as the years go by in practice, we are able to let it go sooner and sooner. So much so that we can assume that eventually we can reach a point where it becomes kind of meaningless. Okay, you have anger for a second? What does that mean? Half a second? There, it's gone. Gone. This may seem far-fetched to people who really do struggle with anger and how they go on brooding and brooding and brooding about it in anger. But we get a little glimpse of this in extended sitting, like sesshin, where we can notice the flare up, and then how quickly it just disappears. He goes on, this Richard Davidson, what we want to get rid of altogether is the ordinary expression of anger that will be perceived as animosity in most cases, except when we have to act in a very energetic way to stop someone from jumping over a cliff. This is an example that they toss around throughout their conference. The idea that, okay, someone's walking toward a cliff absentmindedly, and you say, stop, stop, stop! There, they suggest that would be an example of constructive anger. But then again, I would also wonder, along with the Dalai Lama, whether that really can be called anger. It's certainly a state of arousal, of energy. The same you could see with a parent who sees her toddler toddling out to the street and rushes out and gets angry in that situation. I think the key thing is whether the anger arises from a sense of ego. Whether it comes from self-centered preferences and prejudices, desires and aversions, then it becomes what we would say an indulgence in anger, kind of self-protection, reaction to feeling thwarted. And that also in this this book, Destructive Emotions, is a point that they make quite convincingly. Where another presenter, his name is Paul Ekman, who's done his own research into emotions, a whole range of emotions, where he makes the point that violence is not built into anger, not a necessary or biologically required consequence. And then he maintains, although he admits he doesn't have evidence for it, that what is built into the anger response is the impulse to remove the obstacle that is thwarting us, and that does not necessarily require violence. And then the Dalai Lama asks, are you saying that violence or harming others is not really the purpose or goal of anger from the perspective of the evolutionary theme? That rather the purpose of anger is to stop whatever is interfering? And then he said, that is my view. There isn't evidence, nor is there necessarily agreement among all Western scholars or scientists. I have listed here, and then he gives more, backs up his view, the most common events that precede anger: physical interference, frustration, someone trying to hurt us, another person's anger. I think one of the most obvious examples of this, or supporting examples of this basic cause of anger, feeling thwarted or imposed upon or impeded, is when you're behind the wheel of a car and you experience things that don't normally erupt when someone is getting into your space. As we tend to see it, are holding us up, pulls out, they have right on red, and they pull out in front of us, make us slow down, and then they just poke along. I wouldn't know about that. I think that it's important to accept from the outset that those people who still think it's bad to have anger come up is that we're wired for sex and aggression. I made this point about sex last spring when I gave three successive teshos on sexuality, sex and sexuality, and how deeply we are wired to reproduce. And we know that we don't have to act on that sexual impulse. And it's the same with aggression. We have this, what is sometimes called libido. Libido in the broadest sense is just a kind of a psychic energy that can express itself through sex or aggression or other ways, sometimes sex and aggression. But we're just not going to get anywhere with our anger problem until we come to accept that we have anger. It will arise, and again, unless maybe full enlightenment. And so we changed the wording of that precept. I changed it when I took over the center. Previously it had been resolve not to become angry, but to exercise restraint. How do you avoid becoming angry? I'm still waiting to get to that point where you can avoid it altogether. Now, no matter how much I repeat this, we have to accept that's the nature of our body-mind, is to experience anger at times, in some degree at least. I'm not talking about that we have to expect a tantrum once a week, but we will experience, at least in its subtlest forms, we will experience some anger from time to time. No matter how many times I repeat that, the force of conditioning can be very strong. The conditioning that it's bad, it's wrong, that if you're a spiritual person, you shouldn't ever have anger. This is insane. In this book, Destructive Emotions, they distinguish in Buddhism between the causes of anger, distinguish between the immediate and the distant causes. The immediate, of course, is the trigger, and that will different people react. People have different. Someone said, "What was this?" Emerson said, "We boil at different degrees." But there's the trigger. Usually, it's some kind of stress, and then there is the whole backstory of what's gone on in our lives, and that's what makes the eradication of anger so nearly impossible to because of the deep tendencies, what in Buddhism are called latent tendencies. That anger, like other emotions, need not necessarily be manifest. But they are present in the form of these habitual propensities that remain unconscious or dormant until there's some catalyst that provokes them. The mind, I'm reading here from this Paul Ekman, that the mind harbors propensities for different emotional states, including the destructive ones, due to past experiences that have built up into mental habits. These latent propensities are seen as why, if strong anger comes on one occasion, it can come later on another. To help us understand why, if strong anger comes on one occasion, it can come later on another more easily or strongly, even if in the meantime it fades completely and is replaced by loving compassion or forgiveness. Given the right triggering circumstances, the latent anger can come back full strength. So in the Buddhist ideal, the ideal of eradicating destructive emotions, even these latent tendencies need to be uprooted. And he makes the point that, or one of these guys, maybe one of the neuroscientists, makes the point that the amygdala, which is all implicated in explosions of anger, the amygdala and the hippocampus, which controls memory, is related to memory, are right next to each other. Back to the amygdala, it's a little bud in the brain. I'm reading now from Daniel Goleman's Emotional Intelligence. The amygdala may well be a main source of the sudden spark of rage we feel at the driver whose carelessness endangers us. And then he makes the point that anger is the most seductive of the negative emotions. This is really good stuff here. The self-righteous inner monologue that propels it along fills the mind with the most convincing arguments for venting rage. Unlike sadness, anger is energizing, even exhilarating. Anger's seductive, persuasive power may in itself explain why some views about it are so common, that anger is uncontrollable, or that, at any rate, it should not be controlled, and that venting anger in catharsis, that's in quotation marks, is all to the good. There's all kinds of research that that refutes this notion of discharge that we need to discharge our anger in order to sort of purge ourselves of it. In fact, it's very much the opposite. The more we express anger destructively, the more likely we will become angry in the future. A little sidebar here about testosterone. I read a book this summer called The Trouble with Testosterone, and it's about a lot more than anger and testosterone. The author took the name of one of his chapters and made it the title of the book because it's so provocative. He makes the point that testosterone doesn't cause us to be aggressive, but it exacerbates a previous inclination or propensity to be aggressive. And that, this is what's fascinating, is that aggression itself, aggressive behavior, raises testosterone levels as measured in laboratory research. So when we vent, we are raising our testosterone level, and then we get into this cycle, this vicious cycle. Goleman quotes another scientist as saying that escalating anger is a sequence of provocations, each triggering an excitatory reaction that dissipates slowly. In this sequence, every successive anger-provoking thought or perception becomes a mini-trigger for amygdala-driven surges of catecholamines, each building on the hormonal momentum of those that went before. So appreciate this. Every successive anger-provoking thought or perception becomes a mini-trigger. This is where meditation can give us some freedom from anger, is that we have the ability to intervene and let go of these thoughts that act as triggers. This Zillman found that a universal trigger for anger is the sense of being endangered. Endangerment can be signaled not just by an outright physical threat, but also, as is more often the case, by a symbolic threat to self-esteem or dignity, being treated unjustly or rudely, being insulted or demeaned, being frustrated in pursuing an important goal. These perceptions act as the instigating trigger for a limbic surge that has a dual effect on the brain. This is the fight or flight reaction. So when Joe Wilson, on the floor of the House of Representatives, yelled out, "You lie," we can be sure there was a whole backstory there related to this, what Zillman calls perceiving a threat to his self-esteem or dignity, being treated unjustly or rudely. Frank Rich, who is a columnist for the New York Times, wrote a very persuasive column a few weeks ago in which he quoted someone else as saying that this upsurge of rage that is we see from the right wing has behind it a feeling of being under threat, that not only under threat, but that that somehow these extreme crackpots who have all of these malicious things, carrying on signs at these meetings and saying all these really terribly hostile things, that they feel under siege in the deepest way, that their whole world view is not able to stand up to the enormous enormously technological and complex changes that have been happening now for decades, and most recently in the election of an African-American president. You know, that's another thing that's been batted around this week, is after Jimmy Carter, former President Jimmy Carter, made the claim that there's racism behind these most extreme kinds of attacks on Obama and his health care plan. And there are those who say yes, those who say no. I'm one who says yes, that's there. It's just one of a number of factors, but I think that it's been simmering just below the surface for quite a while now. We saw it during the election campaign in spurting out in different ways, exploited by some of the politicians, and not only the Republicans. And it sort of seemed to subside there in the early months of Obama's presidency, but I'm convinced that it is fueling or exacerbating this reaction to his health care plan. I watched a discussion on Jim Lehrer, that's the PBS program every weeknight, where they had four people, three black and one white, who were talking about this accusation by President Carter. And one of the words that I think is very useful, used by one of the black intellectuals in this discussion, was racial anxiety. One of the other black commentators was not denying that there was racism behind this, but he insisted that, okay, of course, racism in some, at least some subtle form, is with us. It's always been with us and always will be with us. He said it's like, you know, Carter saying that there's racism involved in this is like saying there are mosquitoes. Of course, there have always been mosquitoes. There always will be mosquitoes. And now what do we do to deal with it? But I like this phrase, racial anxiety, because I think that's what's underneath, okay, you could call it racism too, but it's the anxiety, the fear underneath this hostility. And I'm convinced that underneath hostility, there is always fear or anxiety. These people are frightened out of their wits, who are screaming at these town hall meetings. And it's useful to keep that in the back of the mind. Just as with a mentally disturbed person who is expressing rage, or even a child who's tantruming, not to get caught up in reacting to the aggression, the anger, the hostility, doing what needs to be done to preserve the peace with the mentally ill person or the child, but all the while remembering that this comes out of fear. It can help us not react in anger to the anger. I'm going to wait until the next Tay Show to get into all kinds of, to address how to work with anger. First, I want to finish just laying out the geography of anger. So again, there's the initial reaction, and then there's the thoughts that we get caught in that nurse the anger. In Destructive Emotions, that's the conference with the Dalai Lama. Paul Ekman talks about resentment, and this is certainly, resentment is a powerful factor in these expressions of rage at these town hall meetings, and also the eruption on the floor of the House of Representatives. He says, resentment may be easily re-aroused, but the key to it is the feeling of unfairness and injustice. And then he compares it to hatred. Hatred, like resentment, is long-standing. It involves at least three emotions: disgust, anger, and contempt. Hatred is focused on a person. It's not focused on a specific injustice or unfairness. This is from Emotional Intelligence. This is another kind of sidebar. The power of anger to damage the heart. He says that the old idea that a hurried, high-pressure, type A personality is at great risk from heart disease has not held up, that idea. But from that failed theory has emerged a new finding. It is hostility that puts people at risk. He says that, he quotes another researcher, Dr. Williams at Duke University, that being prone to anger was a stronger predictor of dying young than were other risk factors such as smoking, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol. And that anger is particularly lethal in those who already have heart disease. He also says that whether anger is expressed or not is less important. Now, this isn't just in terms of one's health. Whether it's expressed or not is less important than whether it is chronic. But from a Mahayana Buddhist perspective, the destructive effects, physiological effects on ourself is less important than the destructive effects on others. I think the case of anger being constructive, it's so unusual. At least 95% of anger, when anger arises, it arises out of this sense of self and other. When you take away self and other through, say, deep absorption in meditation, then there is no arising of what we ordinary anger that we usually mean by anger, because there is no sense of being under threat. Shantideva, the famous 8th century Indian Mahayana Buddhist monk, in his guide to the Bodhisattva career, said that of those afflictions or mental addictions that destroy our minds, the worst of them is anger. Well, we've run out of time, so we'll stop now and resume a week from today, and we'll recite the four vows.